Hello and welcome to Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. Our lives, our voices. I'm Eric Jansen. This week, my guest is philanthropist and former ambassador to Luxembourg, James C. Hormel. The Gay and Lesbian Center at the San Francisco Public Library bears his name, as he was one of the center's instigators and major donors. He was appointed ambassador by President Bill Clinton in 1999 after a years-long and ugly battle with ultra-conservatives, perhaps I should say so-called religious conservatives, so ugly that they even accused him of being a pedophile. Born in Austin, Minnesota in 1933, son of the head of Hormel Foods, makers of Spam, among other meat products, he grew up in a place and time in which gay wasn't really a viable option. After marrying, fathering five children, and becoming a law school dean, all while still in the closet, he eventually found himself and went on to become a political and social activist, philanthropist, and ambassador. His memoir is called Fit to Serve, Reflections on a Secret Life, Private Struggle, and Public Battle to Become the First Openly Gay U.S. Ambassador. He's here with me live in the studio to talk about his book and his quite interesting life. Ambassador James Hormel, welcome to Out in the Bay.
Thank you very much for having me.
You know, I have lots of questions. So I just have to tell you that when I started reading your book, I was reminded of a comic book character from my childhood in the 1960s, Richie Rich, the poor little rich boy, who had no friends because he lived in an isolated compound. And your childhood, according to your book at least, was similar in some ways. You lived in a 26-bedroom mansion, the only one in Austin, Minnesota at that time, on a 200-acre estate out of town. And on top of that, you began to realize that you were different in other ways. And, you know, maybe Richie Rich was gay too. I don't know. He sort of has a little bit of a foppish look to him when I think back to it. But also, this is back in the 1930s, shortly after the kidnapping and eventual murder, I guess, of aviator Charles Lindbergh's child.
Yeah.
So you and your brothers were kept under constant watch, and there were some other kidnappings around that time. Tell us a little bit more about those to set the context.
Well, needless to say, I don't remember because I was 6 months old at the time. But there was a person who was arrested in Iowa and somehow or other tied to an attempted kidnap, and they found on his person a slip of paper that had my name on it. And that led to, you know, really strong precautionary measures at home, understandably.
And that was a list of names of potential targets that they didn't know for sure were intended kidnap victims, but possibly.
Yeah, it wasn't clear, but we were warned.
Right.
And so I didn't remember a time in my childhood when there wasn't an armed guard around or some surveillance of some kind. And it made it very uncomfortable.
And so you had that sort of isolation. You didn't really have playmates in town, right?
It was difficult because we lived outside of town, and the only way I could get back and forth was in a car that was driven by somebody in uniform, and it was just very awkward. So occasionally I would be able to get together with other kids or they would come out, but it was hard.
Mm-hmm. And in school, you were sort of teased a little bit, or maybe teased isn't the right word, but were you teased? Was it kind of a, you know, oh, this the rich Hormel kid, and you talked about the smell from from the plant at certain times of year would come in through the school windows, and it was quite a stench, and they'd kind of blame you, or
it was amusing in a way, but it wasn't amusing to me because I took it very seriously, my relationship in the community. But I related a story about one day when the wind was blowing the wrong way from the packing plant, and the smells that came out of the hide cellar, which were really dreadful, sort of wafted into a classroom. And this was when I was in, I would guess third grade, and one of the kids said in a stage whisper, "It smells like old man Hormel has his feet out the window again." I was so embarrassed. I tried to sort of convey that I didn't notice. But I got home and told my father about it. And he thought it was very funny. He said, "Well, you tell him the next time he says that he should have been around when my grandfather was in town." Well, I wasn't amused. That wasn't what I wanted to hear.
You wanted some sympathy instead
right.
of, okay. And what was the implication that your grandfather's feet were even smellier than his?
Right.
Okay. So what was the packing plant like? Did you go there much as a kid? Did you?
Well, I went there. It was an amazing place because it consisted of, I think, 190 separate buildings that were all connected in one way or another. And the industry in those days operated with gravity, so that so animals went up a ramp to the slaughtering floor, and then they were carved up. It was sort of a reverse assembly line. It was a disassembly line, and parts flowed down with gravity along chutes and escalators and whatever till they got to the ground floor and they were fully processed.
Right. Wow. Sounds like quite an operation, to say the least. And this is a company that your grandfather, was he an immigrant from Germany and he built this plant from the ground up kind of thing?
Or? No, his parents were immigrants, both of them.
Okay.
And he was born in Buffalo, New York, and they moved to Toledo early on.
My mom's hometown.
All right. But when he was 13, and he was the eldest son out of, I think, 10 children, he left home, went to Chicago, went to work for an uncle who was in the meat processing business in Chicago. And that was the beginning of his exposure to the industry. Mm-hmm. So fast forward 20 years, he's a hide salesman on a territory that takes him up into Minnesota and discovers this friendly little town and decides to settle down there.
Mm-hmm.
So he found a partner who had a meat market, and they were doing okay until the meat market burned down and something happened to the cash box, and all of a sudden,
a little suspicious.
There
okay.
they were.
Okay.
So he borrowed money, rented an old creamery building, started slaughtering pigs and making sausage, and that was how the company began.
Mm-hmm. And you used mentioned before, old man Hormel.
Right.
Now, and then there's a chapter in your book or a passage in your book where you talk about wanting to be normal. And you, I guess you and your brother had gone away to boarding school.
Yes.
And
yes.
You wanted to, you know, you were talking about Hormel rhymes with normal was how people were supposed to pronounce it.
Yeah. The story was, and so far as I know, the family had always pronounced it Hormel. The community certainly did. But in the 1930s, in the mid-30s, when the company started advertising on the radio, the advertisers were concerned that Hormel didn't come across clearly and that Hormel was much more understandable. So they urged the company to use the Hormel pronunciation when advertising the product. So it began, and then people got confused because some people said Hormel, and finally there was an ad which says whether you call it Hormel or Hormel, you just know you're right.
Hmm.
But the family always thought Hormel in their minds, and when I was a boy growing up, it didn't feel quite appropriate. So,
right.
And my brother, in a stopover at the Cincinnati train station, made a little medallion for my father that said, J.C. Hormel rhymes with normal.
And so does your family to this day, have to, you know, privately, do you all go Hormel or is it just or has your family changed its pronunciation based on marketing?
Well, I think the family pronunciation has changed. But in Austin, Minnesota, it is still pronounced Hormel, and I was there recently, like weeks ago, and I fell very easily into the old pronunciation.
So you had this somewhat isolated childhood, and then you had some kids. Your mother was French.
Yeah,
had met your father in World War One, right?
That's right.
And so you had some French and some English kids come to live with you during the war because they were fleeing the war stuff that was going on in their countries.
That's correct, yes. And that was really horrible. I mean, we don't have a concept because we've all lived past the Civil War. We don't have a concept of the destruction of war in this country. We haven't really been hit by it except for Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. And over in England, for example, whole towns were leveled by bombs. And it was a terrific, really terrifying experience for people there. So my godmother, who was English, sent her children to live with us, and her niece came, and my two cousins from France, and we were all kids growing up within a sort of age range of 7 years or so. So it was like a sudden, very large family.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And did that, how did that change your sort of, view of the world, having kids from another country and war? I mean, I'm certain the war effort was all around you in the United States, but now you have some people who are directly affected by it living with you.
Yeah, and it's interesting because we didn't talk about it. We didn't talk about how their families who were still over there might be affected, and we didn't talk about what they had already seen when they arrived. But we paid a lot of attention to what was happening. Mm-hmm. And I suppose that I knew a lot more about the war than the average 7 to 12-year-old kid would know.
Mm-hmm.
Also, it happened that our family had visited Hawaii in 1939. I was 6 years old, and I could remember going to Pearl Harbor and going into a submarine, actually, and seeing elements of the fleet sitting there, and also seeing very large stacks of scrap iron along the highway, and was told that was iron that had been sold and was going to be shipped to Japan, and little did we know that 2 years later it'd be coming right back at us. So there are memories. Mm-hmm. There are certain memories.
So you then went to boarding school, and I'm curious to know if that's when your attraction to other boys became obvious to you, or if that was more not until college.
Well, at that time, it could have been obvious if I had wanted to really admit to it. But, what was equally obvious to me was that was not the way society operated, especially in the 40s. And this was in the late 40s. So I resisted my impulses, and I thought of myself as being strange and eventually, bad somehow, because this was, I was never told, gay is bad. I was never told gay is wrong. People didn't talk about sex at all.
Well, right. And how did the concept of gay, the way we think of it today, even exist then, really?
It existed in certain underground circles, which I didn't know about at the time because they were, people who were adults.
Right.
Who met in conditions where they used code words to communicate, and being gay was like a code word. Mm-hmm. Feeling gay today, or something like that.
Right, right, right.
And it eventually crept into the lexicon, but it crept in the back door. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, tell us what your what college life was like for you.
College, in some ways, was easier than boarding school because I went to an all boys school, and there was constant attraction around me.
You're talking about the boarding school, you mean?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And I didn't feel so much that way in college, and especially when I went to Swarthmore, which was a co-ed school, approximately half women, and. Mm-hmm. And I very soon met someone who was attractive to me, and we developed a relationship that turned into our marriage.
Mm-hmm. So at the time, it didn't seem, did you have reservations about getting married? I guess I'm trying to get an idea of what kind of sense you had of your attraction to men more primarily, and, but this was the thing to do.
Well, I firmly wanted to believe that my attraction to men would pass. I absolutely wanted to believe that, and I don't know whether I really did believe it deep down inside, but that's what manifested itself to me and what I manifested out to the world. And I just thought that Alice and I had a love that was strong enough that it would carry us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And during your marriage, you talk about this in the book, during your marriage and while you were dean of students at the University of Chicago Law School, you had rendezvous with other men, right?
I did.
Yeah, and you mentioned just a moment ago about the sort of code words that existed. So you sort of tapped into this. And you mentioned in the book that kind of it was sort of easier than you thought it would be to sort of find places or find men and I don't know what the word I'm looking for exactly is, but that even though it wasn't spoken about, it was not that difficult in a way.
Well, you know, people joke about gaydar,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it's not a joke. I mean, there really is a sensibility or a sensitivity that manifests itself in some form that I cannot describe.
Mm-hmm.
But it was not difficult to identify people who were either gay or bisexual or willing to experiment. I don't know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And mention in the book also that you had been encouraged to run for Congress, I believe it was at that time, right?
Yes.
And contemplated it, but feared that your sexual activities might be exposed either during your campaign or while you were in office if you were elected. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, yes. In the 50s, in the beginning of the 50s, actually, there was a concerted effort to expose gay people in the government, in Washington in particular. And that began in the State Department.
Mm-hmm. The Lavender Scare, it was called?
The Lavender Scare, and there's a book, and I think there's a film being made about that. At any rate, it caused a lot of people to end their careers. Mm-hmm. In government service, and it caused a lot of other people not to even try to go into government service, unfortunately, because I think the country lost a lot of really fine talent that way. Mm-hmm. And that went on and through the 50s and 60s, very publicly. Senator Joe McCarthy used gay people as a foil, and the common accusation was you couldn't trust them,
mm-hmm.
with secrets, that they could be bribed, that they could be blackmailed, that they could be tricked into exposing information.
Right.
Even though in those 20 years from roughly 1950 to 1970, there wasn't one single case of that kind of activity, not one.
Although it certainly makes some rational sense that if, you know, there was such a taboo on being gay that could be a reason for blackmail for somebody to, you know, not be exposed so they'll do something.
But, yeah.
Yeah. You're listening to Out in the Bay. My name's Eric Jansen. My guest is philanthropist and former ambassador James C. Hormel, who became the highest-ranking openly gay U.S. official in 1999 after a long, nasty battle with the religious right. You can learn more about him in his memoir, Fit to Serve, Reflections on a Secret Life, Private Struggle, and Public Battle to Become the First Openly Gay U.S. Ambassador, at his website, jamesc.hormel.com. So, back in this time in Chicago, you were Republican then, and I'm curious to know how conservative you were and how different the Republican Party was at that time than it is today.
Well, there was a spectrum of Republicanism in the party, and it went from, you know, what we see today to what one would have to call liberal. I mean, beyond moderate. And that included people like Nelson Rockefeller. It included Charles Percy, who was president of a company called Bell & Howell that made cameras, essentially, and a very successful businessman who chose to run for the Senate in the mid-60s. And he was the last Republican whom I supported politically. He was elected, I believe, in 1966. Very interesting person who had, I think he was a person of principle who had a great interest in foreign affairs and in maintaining the relationships between the United States and our allies in ways that I think many people at that time were shunning, because there was sort of a wave of isolationism after World War II, as there was after World War I.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was an element of the party which I found attractive. And then Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Acts of 64 and 65, and suddenly there was a great migration of Democrats, mainly from the South, mm-hmm. into the Republican Party, and the party's attitudes shifted dramatically, so that people like Senator McCarthy, who was no longer around by then, but people like him began to look like Republican leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And that was sort of the end of it for me. I couldn't cope with the hypocrisy that started to crop up. You know, the big tent is one thing, but you know, the limits of prejudice when they seep through the entire party just didn't. You know, I couldn't stay with it anymore. I don't know how else to say it.
Sure. And you, I'm not sure exactly where this. I can't remember where this happened in the chronology. But one of your jobs at the University of Chicago was to law school was to bring in more minority students, right?
Well, I made it my job. Mm-hmm. I really was appalled that there were so few women and so few minorities in the law school. There was a reason for it. And the reason was that law firms weren't hiring.
Mm-hmm.
Law firms had their own traditional patterns of hiring, and they were often almost, I should say, almost exclusively white males.
Mm-hmm. And you had been, you mentioned a trip that you'd taken to the Deep South at one point and really being, having an eye-opening experience at some of the extreme poverty that you saw there. Just on the other side of it, all of a sudden the roads changed from paved to dirt.
And there were open sewers and things like that. So you could really, you could tell. And if you couldn't see that, you could see little kids with bloated bellies that revealed their malnutrition. Mm-hmm. And it was frightening to me, because I had not been exposed to that aspect of our country before. And I had just been to Cambodia. I mean, I literally was in Cambodia within months of the trip to Mississippi, and I saw poverty there. I saw, you know, almost universal poverty, but I did not see the malnutrition, and I did not see the misery.
Mm-hmm.
I saw people coping.
Okay. So we're getting towards the Vietnam War era now, right? I mean, when was this trip to Mississippi? Was that quite a ways before?
No, that was around 1969, 1970.
Okay. So, and then this is the time when a lot of people, especially college students, were challenging the status quo, a time of massive upheaval, which was reflected in popular music at the time. So I'm going to give us a little flavor of that, put us in that era a little bit. Here's part of a Buffalo Springfield song that became an anthem of the late 1960s and early 70s.
Battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speaking their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. I think time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. What a field day for the heat. A thousand people in the street singing songs and carrying signs. Mostly say hooray for our side.
It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Paranoia strikes.
That was Buffalo Springfield, little anthem of the 1960s and 70s. I'm Eric Jansen. You're listening to Out in the Bay. My guest is philanthropist and former ambassador James C. Hormel. So, Jim, how did the social upheaval affect you?
Well, it was stunning to me because in the mid-60s, all these things happened to me almost at once. It was 1965 when my wife and I separated. And in 1966, I made the first tentative efforts at coming out. Meanwhile, I had read a piece by Andy Kopkind in, I think, the New York Times magazine about Vietnam, which exposed me to ideas, thoughts, and facts that I had not absorbed before and made me realize that the war was a sham, that we had been led into a situation for whatever reasons, I should say we had been misled into a situation. And then I started seeing what was going on politically, and it was all very distressing to me. I couldn't feel comfortable in any of those circumstances. Ultimately, I left the University of Chicago, moved to New York, and spent time just sort of dealing with myself. Somebody said, what are you doing in New York? Uh-huh. I said, well, I'm listening to my hair grow.
Yeah, right. Oh, there's some great photos of you in here, by the way, with long hair. Yeah, that's great. There's a little section in the middle of the book that has, plates of, there must be about 10 or 15 pages of photographs, family photographs and various posts. Giving President Clinton a tie.
Oh, yes.
Or a candidate. Was he president at that point? Yes, he was president by then.
He had come to San Francisco with a terrible task. He had to close a naval base, Alameda. And so it was the fall of 1993, I believe. Maybe it was a little earlier. And it was the very beginning of his presidency. It was a terrible task. He realized he had to start. And this is how he started. So he appeared there. It was interesting because while we were waiting, we were standing next to the crew of the Carl Vinson, which is a aircraft carrier that has about 6,000 people aboard. It's like a very small city.
Sure.
And so I'm standing next to this guy, 19 years old. I start asking him about his background. He's from Texas. He's got a Hispanic surname. And I said, well, what do you think about don't ask, don't tell? He thought I was asking, what is don't ask, don't tell? And he started to explain. I said, no, I understand what it is. I said, I'm just wondering how you feel about it. And he said, you know, there are thousands of us living together on this ship for 6 months at a time. And we have various very restricted tasks to perform. And we must work together and do our job together. He said, I know quite a few people on this ship who are gay. And so does everybody else. And it does not make one bit of difference to us.
So I'm skipping ahead a little bit here, but you were a big supporter of President Clinton. As a matter of fact, you were a major donor to his campaign, and that's part of the reason someone suggested that you should pursue an ambassadorship. And yet, then he came along, and he's the one who came up with Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and he's the one who signed the Defense of Marriage Act. And I'm curious, you know, how you feel about him now, and how you feel about those particular actions he took.
Well, those two were really, I think, tragedies. I don't know how else to describe them. Don't Ask, Don't Tell was the result of his trying in his very first year as president to do away with the restrictions that prevented gay people from serving in the military. That's what he wanted to do. And he thought he could do it by fiat and discovered suddenly that he could not, and was sort of forced into a corner. And the result was don't ask, don't tell.
And that was supposed to be some sort of a compromise policy?
Well, it was. And I think people saw it, people who supported it saw it as a way of allowing gay men and women to serve in the military, you know, without having to discharge them. Mm-hmm. What actually happened was that thousands of people were discharged, and others were persuaded not to join the military. So, and some of those people were really needed. They were necessary. There were linguists and you know, people who would have made an enormous difference as we moved through the crises in Iraq, for example. But they were kept out or they were kicked out. I knew someone who was a student at the U.S. Naval Academy. He was in the last month of his senior year. He was an outstanding cadet. He had all kinds of awards and recognitions. He had sung the Star-Spangled Banner at two Army-Navy football games during his career at the Naval Academy. And within a month of his graduation, he was expelled. Mm-hmm. And the Navy demanded that he pay them for his college experience.
Wow, yeah.
So that's the kind of thing that happened under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. The consequences, I'm sure, were unintended by the president. But ultimately, what the act did was to require people to lie.
Mm-hmm, right, absolutely.
It's a terrible thing to do. That's not what our government should be doing.
Well, thank goodness it's finally ended. You're listening to Out in the Bay. We'll have much more from Jim Hormel after a very brief break. Don't touch that dial. We'll be back in a minute. You're hearing a special hour-long edition of Out in the Bay. KALW graciously provides us airtime and studio use. As an independent, nonprofit production, however, we receive no financial support from KALW, NPR, nor any other institution. Your gift would truly make a difference in keeping us here for you every week, and it'd make me really happy, really. So please consider a tax-deductible contribution. It's easy on our website, outinthebay.com. You can also hear this week's program in its entirety there and the last 6 months' worth of our shows anytime you want. And sign up for free weekly podcasts. It's all on our website, outinthebay.com. Thank you. And we're back. You're listening to Out in the Bay. I'm Eric Jansen. My guest is Ambassador James Hormel. We were just talking about President Clinton's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, and you also wanted to say something about DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, which President Clinton signed.
Well, DOMA came along in 1996, and by that time there were stirrings about marriage, about marriage equality in particular. In 1990, there were three couples who sued the state of Hawaii because they had been refused marriage licenses. And the state Supreme Court eventually held that, you know, unless there were some compelling reason, that they should be granted those licenses. And what ultimately happened was that there was a campaign that became really kind of nasty, in which people were promoting an amendment to the state constitution that would prevent the issuance of those marriage licenses. And that's what happened. So that was the beginning of a whole series of actions around the United States. By 1996, I think several states had done that and many others would follow. So also in 1996, President Clinton was facing re-election with the prospect of Ross Perot being in the contest again. It was very unclear whether he could survive. People in the Congress were looking for any possible way that they could impeach him. And the process was taking its toll. And I think
so. This is about the time of the whole Monica Lewinsky scandal.
It was, yeah.
And this is when this is the same election. It was the Newt Gingrich and that whole, I don't remember, what was the name of it? The something sweep.
Contract on America.
Yeah, he had his contract.
Like it.
Yeah.
It was contract with America.
The contract on America, yes.
but the president was caught up in the politics of it, I do believe. Mm-hmm. And so
if he hadn't signed it, what do you think the consequences would have been for him?
I don't know. I mean, he did have difficult choices. He was elected twice by pluralities. He never had a majority. So people forget that. They forget it partly because he was so effective when he was president, and he did such incredible things in spite of the challenges that were partly self-created and certainly inflicted by a hostile Senate. Mm-hmm. So I was very disappointed with DOMA. I really feel that it is patently unconstitutional, and it's going to fall in some way sooner or later. I hope it's sooner because I want to see the day.
Mm-hmm. And there's been some progress. I mean, very recently, you had an article in the this is from the Huffington Post just about a month ago. Talking about the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee voting in favor of the Respect for Marriage Act, which is to basically repeal DOMA, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I mean, is that just one of these little tiny committee things, and who knows how long it's going to really take for it to reach the full floor? And, you know, similar to your battle to be an ambassador?
Well, who knows? But it was voted out of committee, and our Senator Dianne Feinstein was the primary mover of that. She sits on the Judiciary Committee. And she was a sponsor of the Respect for Marriage Act. So we'll see where it goes. But meanwhile, it's going through the courts in at least 8 or 9 different cases now. Mm-hmm. And the cases are different. They involve military people. They involve civilians. They involve the restriction of rights that a normal couple receives but DOMA prevents same-sex couples from receiving. So, excuse me, the trials, I think, are headed toward appeals that will eventually lead to a decision. And I just can't believe that the decision could be anything other than to hold it unconstitutional.
We'll cross our fingers.
Yes. Really.
Activist judges, please. No.
But, you know, if you read the opinion of Justice Scalia in the Lawrence versus Texas case in 2003, when he objected to the abolition, the court ruled abolition of the so-called sodomy statutes, he said, you know, the logical next step is same-sex marriage. And he's right. Mm-hmm. It is the logical next step.
Right. So let's go back to your story a little bit. You became a Democratic activist, a big supporter of Bill Clinton in 1992 when he was running for president the first time, and he won.
Yes.
And someone suggested to you that you seek an appointment, which at first you thought was, you know, odd or wrong in some way. Why should you get a, you know, some plum assignment just because you gave a lot of money? But then you thought about that and decided to pursue it. So what made you change your mind and decide to pursue it?
Well, first of all, it wasn't any someone. It was Clinton's campaign treasurer. And he also happened to be a gay man. Mm-hmm. And so his suggestion carried some meaning to me. It wasn't frivolous. He said, look at the list of administrative appointments and see if there's something on there that appeals to you and then pursue it. Well, I looked at the list and there wasn't much. There were a lot of interesting commissions and that sort of thing, and some of them I felt I would be qualified for and others not. But what was compelling about an ambassadorial post was that it required Senate confirmation. And if I went in that direction, I could compel members of the Senate to go on record about LGBT issues, which I thought would be a significant advancement. At least it would bring public attention to issues that were not being talked about. So that led me to make inquiries, when I heard from several friends who were in Congress that, well, you never know what might happen, I decided to find out.
And you found out. Yeah. So you had this, so it was 1992 when you first, maybe it was a little bit later, when you first started making inquiries about, okay, yeah, I think I'd like to be an ambassador.
No, it was 92.
It was 92, and you didn't get appointed until 99, so, and halfway through 1999. So that's 7 years later, full 7 years. And as you described, the first 2 years, you're like, yeah, I can wait, you know. It's just there's a long list that's got to work his way through. And then something happened in 1994 which made you kind of start to be a little more aggressive about your campaign. Is that fair to say?
Well, what happened was that I had been designated for a post, and the post was Fiji. And Fiji, I discovered immediately, had the so-called sodomy laws that were a holdover from the old British colonial days. So I ran that by people at the State Department, and they investigated and said they didn't think it should be an impediment. Nonetheless, the word leaked that I had been suggested for this position, and Al Kamen, who publishes a sort of political gossip column in the Washington Post, referred to it. There was no apparent reaction in this country, but a couple of months later, there was a very strong reaction in Fiji.
Mm-hmm.
So when that happened, I think that the president hesitated, and understandably so, because you really don't want to send an ambassador to a country where he or she is not wanted. And meanwhile, in 1994, the Democrats lost control of both the House and the Senate, and Jesse Helms, through an assistant on his staff, let it be known that my nomination, as I was told, would not reach the light of day.
Mm-hmm. Okay, right. So that was 94. Right. So maybe 94 was the midterm elections, where there was this huge Republican sweep, which I was referring to earlier, not 96, but that's why Clinton was so worried about reelection and,
indeed, and
felt pressured to sign the Defense of Marriage Act. So Fiji was out of the question then, or some point along the line became, even though you'd sort of gotten some indications from people in Fiji that homosexuality was tolerated, even though there was this law against it, but there was, it was kind of a, you know, it was kind of a don't ask, don't tell.
Exactly.
In Fiji.
Yes.
Okay.
So, yes, I think Fiji became out of the question at that
point. So how did it move to Luxembourg?
Well, I had to do some maneuvering. I had to persuade the White House that that there were other positions that they could appoint me to that would perhaps establish my credibility. And one of them was the Human Rights Commission in Geneva. There is a delegation that changes its composition every year. And the delegation was headed by Geraldine Ferraro at the time. And she was someone who would be supportive of me.
Mm-hmm.
So I managed to get appointed to a delegate to that commission in 1995. And so the next step, so far as I could see, was the UN General Assembly in New York. That was an appointment that required Senate confirmation. But it was done in a manner that that didn't isolate individuals. The whole delegation was confirmed simultaneously.
And after the fact, you said after the service, right?
Yes, and that was partly because the delegation was composed of a member of the House and a member of the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody would want to see them not get confirmed.
Oh, I see. Sure, of course. That would be kind of a bad wind thing, wouldn't it? So you said you were an alternate on that delegation, or you were...
I was an alternate. There were three public members and two congressional members and the ambassador to the UN.
But that established your... first of all, it gave you a little more experience in that sort of international arena, but it also established a sort of precedent that, hey, the Senate's already confirmed me once.
Well, sort of, yeah.
Right. At least that was the hope. So then what happened? Now, so then you're How did the Luxembourg Post specifically come to your attention, how did it become offered to you?
Well, I kept pressing because I said, I think the time is ready to do this, is ripe to do this. And the president, was getting in deeper and deeper hot water with the Republicans. So it was becoming more difficult for him. And he had made several other nominations that sort of fell by the wayside. So I wasn't really confident, but I just had to promote myself, which I'm not very good at. And ultimately, there was somebody on the staff who said, well, where could he appoint you? I said, well, I would look at Western Europe because that's where it would be most difficult to say you can't send a gay person there. Luxembourg was a very interesting country in between France and Germany, the birthplace, as it were, of the European Union. So I suggested it. And as it turned out, there was an opening for Luxembourg.
Okay.
So
it just happened they didn't have an ambassador at that point?
Well, there was an ambassador there, but he was going to be leaving.
Okay.
So I was designated, and they did yet another check on me, security check. I was through, I think, three checks by the FBI alone, and I don't know who else was looking into my background. Then they asked the government of Luxembourg whether they would approve, and the government said yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So at that point, I was nominated. It was fall of 1997.
Okay. So, and that's when things got kind of ugly then, right?
Well, I had a hearing, and the hearing went very smoothly.
This is a hearing at which you thought that Jesse Helms, if I'm not mistaken, or was it someone else, would oppose your nomination.
But yes,
he
had right.
sent a letter, but then he said, okay, we won't oppose it, no problem, as long as you agree to a couple of things. I can't remember what they were. He had a small list.
What he said is, I will not stand in the way.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't say he wouldn't vote against it, which he did. He voted against it.
But he didn't
keep it
off the floor.
Right.
Yeah.
He didn't stand in the way. And the things that he was suggesting were things that he knew wouldn't happen anyway. I mean, such as Mr. Hormel's companion will not be given any official duties. Well, the fact is, even married spouses are not given any official duties in that sort of posting. So he knew the answers before he asked the questions.
Okay.
And I'm not quite sure whether he was just sort of letting himself off the hook.
So you passed the committee, and then... a couple of senators put some sort of holds on it, which they can do anonymously, but this to block it from going to the Senate floor.
That's right.
So who were they and why did they do this? Or,
They were Jim Inhofe and Tim Hutchinson. Inhofe of Oklahoma. And the story that I heard, and I have no idea whether it's true or not, was that he had gone to a Wednesday lunch of an extreme, right-wing Republican group, and that somebody had said, the president has nominated this homosexual to be an ambassador, and nobody is stopping it, mm-hmm. and it should be stopped. And Inhofe went back and put a hold on the nomination.
And then at some point, Reverend Lou Sheldon's organization got a hold of this. Andrea Sheldon, his daughter,
right?
So she went out to the Gay and Lesbian Center of the library, which has your name on it. And what did she find?
She snooped around and found some books which she thought were obscene or whatever she thought. I don't know. And she thought they were offensive in any event. So she called public attention to them and said, these books have, the nameplate, James C. Hormel, Gay and Lesbian Center, San Francisco Public Library. He's putting books into our public library that shouldn't be there.
So how did the connection come in that there was some accusations of pedophilia or?
Well, that had come, I guess, fairly simultaneously. they came, well, to finish with Andrea Sheldon, I just wanted to say that the books that she was calling out were also in the Library of Congress. But at any rate.
Well, since you're mentioning that, I just have to say one thing. One of the points in the book that made me laugh is when you said the second time around she sent a box of crayons to every member of the Senate along with a coloring book. Well, I can't say the full name of the coloring book on public radio, but it was a four-letter word that starts with a C,
yes.
The blank coloring book,
right.
Which I assume was like a feminist, accept your body, accept your sexuality kind of thing.
It was a book that had been published in the 70s, I think.
Yeah, and, I thought as much as let's put it this way. I was amused at the cleverness of the idea to send crayons along with along with this book to every member of the Senate.
Really? Yes. Well, the pedophilia charge came from Pat Robertson, and I was surprised because I had no advance notice that this was going to happen. But he had one of his 700 club programs was kind of dedicated to this. And they put on what really was a totally false show of protest against my nomination. They spoke of a crowd, and the crowd consisted of, I think, about 9 people, led by Christine O'Donnell, the so-called witch from Delaware. Remember Christine O'Donnell?
I don't, actually.
She ran for Congress.
Okay.
She ran for Congress last time, and all of these wonderful things came out about her, including her her supposed witchhood.
Right. Okay, yes, it's coming back to me now, yeah.
So Pat Robertson described me as a pedophile, he pronounced it, a pedophile advocate. And a supporter of NAMBLA, the North American Man-Boy Love Association, which is just outrageous. I mean, the charges were without any basis.
But there were publications from some NAMBLA publications that happened to be in the collection, and as you said, also in the collection of Congress or
something
Library
like
of Congress.
That. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's where he got it.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And then they also accused it of being anti-Catholic because you had been one of the key pieces of evidence was a videotape. Of you doing some being interviewed by Jim Gabbard and some reporter Coffee TV 20 when they were used to broadcast the San Francisco Pride Parade.
It was live. Ginger Casey, and I knew Ginger. So we were talking, and all of a sudden she said, "Oh, here come the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence. We have to pay attention to these girls." And I said to myself, "Well, okay, that means we're not going to talk for a few minutes." So Ginger said, legend has it that the sisters acquired their habits from a convent in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, after telling the nuns that they needed the costumes for a performance of The Sound of Music, at which I laughed. I thought it was funny. And Tim Hutchinson managed to translate that into anti-Catholicism. I never said it at the time, and I kind of wish I had, but Tim Hutchinson was an alumnus of Bob Jones University. And the things that Bob Jones Sr. and Bob Jones Jr. and Bob Jones III have said about the Catholic Church would burn anybody's ears.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned that in the book, too, that you left that meeting. You never said anything about it, but you wish you had left this meeting in his office and saying, "Hey, what about this?" And you, I mean, you think that to sort of fight fire with fire would have maybe gotten you anywhere any faster? Or who knows?
Well, I guess that I can take solace in the fact that eventually Jim Inhofe's office computer system shut down because it was overloaded with pornography.
And, so he had his own problems or indiscretions.
I think the very day that I was sworn in, it was announced that Tim Hutchinson's wife had divorced him because he had been having an affair with somebody on his staff.
Mm-hmm. So President Clinton finally appointed you during a recess because these two senators were able to block, and your nomination never became, your confirmation never came to the full Senate floor. So eventually President Clinton assigned you during a recess appointment.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. There was a third senator eventually, Bob Smith of New Hampshire, who was offended because I had helped to sponsor a film called It's Elementary, which was designed to prepare teachers to deal with the issue of homosexuality at the grade school level. And they showed a very unflattering clip mm-hmm. of Senator Bob Smith at the beginning of that video. So I became his enemy.
Ah, as well. Okay. Well, you know, it's amazing to me how fast the hour flew by. I'm used to doing a half an hour, and I thought, how am I going to possibly talk for a whole hour with you? But here's we are at the end of the hour almost. And so just kind of quickly, I want to ask you, you know, where are we, you know, where do you see us now as a community and what our biggest challenges are? And do you think, you know, well, how's President Obama doing for LGBT rights?
Well, the president has done some wonderful things, and he certainly has pursued Don't Ask, Don't Tell to its own fare thee well. He has probably appointed more openly gay people to his administration than all other administrations combined. That's my guess, even though President Clinton appointed quite a few. And he certainly has encouraged the Secretary of State to take the position she's taken with respect to gay rights issues internationally and that incredible speech that she gave a couple of weeks ago. So, you know, I've got to give him a lot of credit. Things have not happened that we wished would happen. I don't think that DOMA is as important to the public at large as the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, which has sat around in Congress for almost 40 years in one form or another and still hasn't passed. Meanwhile, there are, I think, 29 states in which a person can be fired for just being gay. So there's that. And DOMA and ENDA need to be addressed. There's no doubt about it. But he's, you know, now he's in a hostile congressional situation. Back in the day, you know, the Senate used to make decisions by majority. Now they don't. They make decisions by 60-40 or more. And it's we don't have a democracy anymore, not the kind that was intended. We do have a plutocracy where money speaks. And I think that's very unfortunate. And we also have a society where people think that being gay is a choice. And some of the current presidential candidates have said it much. Well, that's what they choose to do. Well, no, it is not. It's not a choice.
I wish we had time because I've got 20 more questions, and I have questions that some people had sent me from our Facebook page that I wanted to ask you, but I'm sorry I'm not going to be able to get to them. Ambassador Hormel, I want to thank you so much for sharing your story with us. Listeners, you can learn more about Ambassador James C. Hormel and his book, Fit to Serve, Reflections on a Secret Life, Private Struggle, and Public Battle to Become the First Openly Gay U.S. Ambassador at his website, jamesc.hormel.com. You've been listening to Out in the Bay, independently produced by me and Marilyn Pittman. We've been producing Out in the Bay for 7 years now, and many of you have told us how positive, entertaining, and informative you find it. We appreciate those words of support, and we'd like your financial support, too. We thank KALW for studio use and airtime. As an independent production, we do not receive any financial assistance from the station, though. So it's easy, and it's tax-deductible. Please go to our website and hit the Donate Now button and make a contribution, big or small, to keep us going. That's outonthebay.com, where you can also sign up for free weekly podcasts, listen to 6 months' worth of archived shows, and sign up for Stitcher, the application that lets you download radio programs to mobile devices. It's all free on our website, outonthebay.com. Thanks to WY Enterprises for maintaining outonthebay.com, services for your life and your business, wyenterprises.com. Thanks also to our engineer this week, Joanne Marr. We'd love to hear from you with segment suggestions, general comments, and questions. Are you there? Please write to us, eric@outonthebay.com. And Marilyn@outinthebay.com. I'm Eric Jansen. Thanks for listening.